WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is just editing the show this week. I'm Bob Garfield. On Monday, history was made. Or not, depending.
Hillary Clinton has 2,384 delegates right now. That is if you include the superdelegates, which we are including.
Superdelegates, mainly Democratic Party officials, members of Congress, and sitting governors, are counted like any other delegate at the convention in Philadelphia. But unlike the pledged delegates won in primaries and caucuses, superdelegates aren't officially in a candidate's pocket until the actual convention vote. They're similar to Schrödinger's cat of physics fame, simultaneously existing and not yet existing. It was after canvassing these cats about their intentions that the Associated Press added pro-Hillary superdelegates to the pledged delegates and reported that she had clinched the nomination. An historic headline, but problematic for two reasons. First, the timing. The AP declared the race was over on Monday night, the day before contests were held in six states. This to the frustration of many, like Los Angeles City Council member and Bernie Sanders supporter Gil Cedillo.
It's voter suppression in the most rank and raw form. What's next, literacy tests or a poll tax? This is not something that a legitimate news agency should be involved with.
Intentional suppression? Well, let's just say that's not supported by evidence. The second complaint is maybe harder to ignore, that the media shouldn't be counting superdelegates in the first place, because, as the Democratic National Committee's Luis Miranda explained to CNN in April,
they're likely to change their minds. You look at 2008, and what happened then was there was all this assumption about what superdelegates were going to do, and many of them did change their mind.
Kathleen Carroll is the AP's executive editor. She says that talking to delegates to suss out their leanings is a routine part of AP's election coverage and has been for decades. So when the pledged plus the committed superdelegates passed the nomination threshold, they never considered waiting to report it.
We deliver news to the public when we have it. And when we got to the count that gave her the number of delegates and superdelegates needed based on what the superdelegates were telling us, and we only count them as committing to one candidate or another when they tell us on the record and by name. So when we got to that number, it was news. And what we do with news is distribute it. I think you and I would be having a very different kind of on the media conversation if we had news and had suppressed it.
Oh, we certainly would have. Yes, sirree. But there's one thing about the superdelegates. It is a vote at the convention, but by the rules of the Democratic Party, it isn't a vote until the convention. So did you have any news?
Well, yes, we did. And if you read our coverage, we go to great pains to explain what we have counted and what that means. And in each and every one of those explanations, we make clear two things. One, that superdelegates are party officials, and they can change their minds before the convention. And two, we've been talking to them since 2015, and so far, none of the superdelegates who have told us that they plan to vote for Hillary Clinton have changed their mind in all of that time.
On an election day, even with very reliable exit poll results of what the outcome will be, the press does hold our fire until the polls have closed, lest we influence the vote. So we know what's going to happen. We have the news. It's in our hands. But we want to let the voters have their say. That convention has often been invoked during the course of the week in criticism of the AP. Why not withhold till the polls have closed in California for fear of influencing the very election you're covering?
First, on an election day, exit polls often are really useful for telling you why people voted, but they are only one of several factors that will tell you how the vote will go. So withholding the results of exit polls makes much more sense because an exit poll alone is not precise enough to call a race on in most cases unless it's blowout. Number two, the media outlets, including AP, who follow that line generally, are doing so because the vote is taking place that day. that was not happening on Monday, and we were describing two things. Votes that already had happened, those are the pledged delegates. They are, in fact, a majority of the count of delegates. And superdelegates, which we precisely told everyone, said they intended to vote for her or intended to vote for Bernie Sanders. And we described that that was something that was going to happen well beyond the Tuesday of Election Day. So I understand why people think that this is analogous, but it isn't. It really isn't.
Okay, it wasn't the day of the election. I grant you that. It was the day before the election, less than 12 hours before polls opened in New Jersey. Isn't that a distinction without a difference?
No, I don't think it is a distinction without a difference. You know, we put the news out when we were sure that we'd gotten to the count. And we would have done the same thing had it occurred 2 days earlier or whenever it occurred. It just happened to be Monday night at 8:20. Let me put another thought on the table here. California and New Jersey, very populous states, have primaries in June. If you look back in history, nominees often are decided well before June arrives. Now, the officials in those states have made a decision that June is the right date for the primaries for them. But when I lived in California over the years, many people complained that the largest state in the union didn't have the right influence in the primary process because the primary took place so late. So if it had been decided by something else before the June primary in California, would that have suppressed turnout? The voters have to make their own decisions. I believe giving them information is our responsibility, and that's what we did.
Kathleen, thank you so much.
All right, Bob, thanks very much.
Kathleen Carroll is the AP's executive editor. Bill Mitchell is a journalist and former head of Pointer.org, and he has a different view on the AP's decision. Not that he was surprised by it, because MSNBC's Chris Matthews spilled the beans to his viewers weeks ago.
June 7th, 8 o'clock that night Eastern time, the networks will be prepared, including this one, to announce that Hillary Clinton has now gotten over the top. It's done. What will that do to turnout if that's 5 o'clock Pacific time with three more hours to vote in California?
That was one of the things that tipped me off to start thinking about the consequences of the way these superdelegates especially are counted.
They had the news. They've been canvassing these delegates for many, many months. Had they failed to report it, wouldn't that be sitting on a story, withholding news from the readers?
It would have been. It would have been absolutely the wrong thing to do. To dig into the issue of superdelegates, I think that's the kind of rigorous reporting the AP is known for, and it was a good idea to do. What I think they did wrong was portraying what they came up with to carry much more significance than it actually did. Those superdelegates will not actually cast their votes until the July 25th convention. And it's certainly true that none of the superdelegates have changed their preferences. But I think to simply assume, especially in a year like this one, that things will turn out as journalists and political prognosticators think they will is really driving past our headlights.
However, I'm looking at the AP story, and it says Hillary Clinton has commitments from the number of delegates needed to become the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee for president and will be the first woman to top the ticket of a major U.S. political party. It's a bit of a hedge. It's couched in a way that makes it dependent on the commitments. They seem to have, at a minimum, covered their butts.
But I think the thrust of the story is all drumroll and fanfare. You know, it begins striding into history. Hillary Clinton will become the first woman. The AP should have made it quite clear how much of a staggering lead Clinton had developed, but I think stopped short of declaring her the first woman nominee.
They are headed for the convention. They have told reporters at the AP their intentions. And at some point in the future, those votes will count, but they don't count yet. Is it for the AP to hew to the Democratic Party's internal rules or to take these delegates at their own word?
I think they should make an independent judgment. So I have no problem with them taking these delegates at their own word. I would have preferred if That word was not anonymously expressed as it was with some of the delegates in the latest count, but I understand why that might not have been possible to get everyone on the record. So I applaud the AP for acting independently from Democratic rules, but I still don't think that opens the way for the kind of declaration of victory that resulted. And all I'm suggesting is that it might be time for journalists to ease up on journalistic omniscience. We have to stop short of declaring her the winner until actually she receives the nomination.
All right, Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Bill Mitchell is former head of Poynter.org. Coming up, Clinton's ascendancy is one historic moment. Donald Trump's is quite another. Does his demand a new kind of journalism? This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For the rest of the hour, we're going to be looking into the complex, turbulent, and utterly codependent relationship between Donald Trump and the media. You probably already know how Trump feels about us, but in case you've forgotten...
Look, the media, you know my opinion of the media. It's very low. I think the media is, frankly, made up of people that, in many cases, not in all cases, are not good people. The press should be ashamed of themselves. Like this sleazy guy right over here from ABC. He's a sleaze, in my book. You're a sleaze because you know the facts, and you know the facts well. I'm going to continue to attack the press. Look, I find the press to be extremely dishonest. I find the political press to be unbelievably dishonest. I will say that.
Well, that's a fine how do you do from a man who has built his insurgent campaign entirely on the backs of the media, who have for a year dutifully reported everything that has come out of his mouth. The question is, how should we be dealing with him? I personally have agitated for an aggressive confrontational approach of the sort that modern press traditionally avoids. So now we explore what, if anything, should change when a candidate such as Trump is just one November Tuesday away from the presidency of the United States. First, we speak to Paul Waldman, senior writer for the American Prospect and a blogger for the Washington Post, who says he's been worried about the media's impotence through most of the election season, but that a Trump press conference this week might herald a turning point.
In some ways, it was something that we've seen before, where he came out and criticized reporters. He called one reporter a sleaze. He said they're all dishonest. But what prompted it was simply reporters doing what reporters are supposed to do, which is that there was a story that had some questions that were outstanding about what happened at this fundraiser, where did the money go, did Trump actually make the $1 million donation that he had claimed. And a group of reporters, particularly David Farenthold from the Washington Post, but some others as well, started to investigate this. And they did some shoe leather work. And what they found was that the money didn't seem to have been distributed. That obviously enraged Trump. But I think that what was really important about that was that when he attacked their professionalism for doing what was an excellent job, I think that caused some reflection on the part of the press to say that the best way to handle him is to just do the things that we're supposed to be doing and not just kind of sit back and say, wow, isn't this a crazy campaign, which is what the tone of a lot of the coverage was up until then.
There are a few other developments of the week. One was that CNN started in its chyron, the crawl across the screen that the cable channels used to create the illusion of urgency, would both quote Trump and then truth squad him at the same time in parenthesis and say, this doesn't check out or this isn't true. The New York Times had a story by Adam Liptak raising serious questions about Trump and the rule of law based on his public utterances, and the Judge Curiel thing, which did seem finally to hold his feet to the fire.
The interview that Jake Tapper did with him on the question of whether it was racist for him to attack Judge Curiel for not giving him all the rulings that he wants, that was different from what we ordinarily see in an important way. Usually when journalists get a chance to interview a candidate, they have a whole bunch of questions that they want to get to. And if the candidate dodges a question, they might follow up once or twice, but then they'll just move on. What Tapper did was he just stuck to that one question and kept asking it over and over and over until he got the kind of clarity that he thought was important. And it turned out to be a great move because it got all kinds of attention and it really emphasized the fact that Trump was indeed making a blatantly racist attack on this judge.
That interview may well have been a turning point, but at the same time, to me, it was also kind of part of the problem, which is that Jake, for all his persistence, asked, but never charged, even though there were a whole bunch of manifest facts at his disposal. What is it about the press that makes us refuse, even with tons of evidence, to be in any way prosecutorial?
It's a quandary for reporters because they're not in their news reporting supposed to be taking positions, even with someone like Donald Trump. And so the idea is that you can arrive at the same place by asking the right questions and probing in the right way without coming out so far as to slam your fist down on the table and saying, "You, sir, are a racist." I think that the belief the reporters have is if they cross that line into what seems like advocacy, then they're going to lose credibility and they're not going to be able to persuade large portions of their readership or their viewership who don't already agree with them.
Now, as you may know, I have been arguing quite strenuously to whoever will listen, including on this show, that at this stage the press should take on a role of advocacy. And yet, if you're right, we have reached a turning point where just plain shoe leather journalism is beginning to have an impact. Does this mean that I should have just kept my trap shut and let journalism and politics take their course?
I guess my question is, what would the kind of journalism that you're advocating look like in a real specific way? Does it mean that you would have news stories on the front page of the New York Times or the Washington Post saying, "Donald Trump, comma, who is a liar and a charlatan, today gave a speech in Cincinnati where he said X, Y, and Z"? Conservatives have for decades told their people that you shouldn't believe anything that the mainstream media tell you because it's all saturated with liberal bias. And if it's not coming from Fox or from Rush Limbaugh or from a source that you as a conservative can trust implicitly, then it's nothing but a pack of lies. If journalists, I think, were upfront about those kind of judgments, even people who weren't necessarily conservative could look at that and say what the Republicans have been saying about the media really is true. They really are just a bunch of liberals trying to infect us with their bias, and I might as well discount whatever they have to tell me about what happened today.
Elsewhere on this program, we're going to hear novelist Alexander Heman say, why draw the line at Trump? That Trumpism is really just the logical extension of political rhetoric that has been brewing now for 30 years. So why choose him to draw a line in the sand? Is this a time? Is this a historical emergency that should make us rethink journalistic convention?
To be honest, I'm not sure I've decided yet what the answer is. You can argue on one hand that he is not really all that different from things that other Republicans have done. He just kind of strips away the veneer and, you know, puts them right in your face. On the other hand, you can argue that he is something qualitatively different, that he represents a kind of crypto-fascist approach that is uniquely dangerous. I go back and forth on that question on a day-to-day basis. For instance, the way that a lot of cable news has covered Trump, which is basically to just set up a camera at his rallies, let him go for an hour, and then afterward have a bunch of people sit around and say, "Wow, that was crazy." Is that enough? You know, you could even argue that Trump is going to dig his own grave this way. And that even as he has been successful in appealing to people in his party enough to get the nomination, that at the same time he's alienating so many other people that it's not even necessary for reporters to, you know, bash people over the head with the idea that it's really, really bad. So, sorry, I don't have a more definitive answer.
You're not quite saying just let the cameras roll. And you're not saying, I'm with you, Bob, let's throw everything we have against this guy. You seem to be advocating some sort of middle ground grounded in your belief that journalism, when left to do what it does, will be all that's needed.
Yeah, that's what I would like to believe. If Trump was running a scam on people with Trump University, then just investigating it and getting all the facts and putting them in front of people, that should be the most powerful indictment if it indeed was a scam. And the same thing is true of, you know, his policy plans. If they're crazy, if the reporters who are trying to objectively report the story, if they are laying out all those facts, then they're going to provide all the raw materials that anyone would need to create the indictment. And so it might not be necessary for them to be as prosecutorial, and you'd end up in the same place at the end. That's what I would hope anyway.
Paul, thank you.
My pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a senior writer for the American Prospect and blogger for the Washington Post. You just heard him cite CNN's Jake Tapper's interview with Trump last week as part of this changing tide in Trump coverage. Tapper followed up an astonishing 23 times with the candidate over Trump's assertion that federal judge Gonzalo Curiel is incapable of treating him fairly in a lawsuit about so-called Trump University.
But he's an American. You keep talking about
Jake.
It's a conflict
Jake.
Of interest because of Mexico.
Are you ready?
But I don't care if you criticize him. That's fine. You can criticize every decision. What I'm saying is, if you invoke his race as a reason why he can't do his job.
I think that's why he's doing it. Okay, I'm building a wall. I am going to do very well with the Hispanics, the Mexicans.
So everybody. No Mexican judge could ever be involved in a case that involves you?
He's a member of a society where, you know, very pro-Mexico, and that's fine. It's all fine. And he said, no, I won't dismiss the case, and she doesn't have to be the plaintiff.
Let me
tell
you.
I'll tell you what it has to do.
If you are saying he can't do his job because of his race, is that not the definition of racism?
No.
It's not the first time Tapper has put Trump on the defensive. Among the stable of cable news and network interviewers, Tapper has distinguished himself by reliably asking tough, pointed questions. Getting straight answers? Well, he's in the same boat as everyone else. Because the conventions of journalism, especially broadcast journalism, give politicians ample opportunity to duck and cover. So, do these conventions need to change? Jake, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, he's hard to interview, obviously. He makes unverifiable claims. He changes the subject a lot, interrupts. How do you prepare for a Trump interview?
A lot of these people are tough to interview. There's kind of a world of, all right, I will ask Senator X this question. He will dodge it. I will ask it again. He will pivot to topic Y, and then maybe if I have the fortitude to ask it a third time, I will finally get something resembling an answer. That is a general format that I'm used to. I had a lot of questions I wanted to ask Mr. Trump about trade, immigration, counterterrorism. By the time I sat down with him, there were two big stories. One was Hillary Clinton's speech attacking him and his reaction to it, and his comments about Judge Curiel. I felt like the most important question I had was whether that was not the definition of racism.
Well, you certainly hammered him with the question. And
I hate to be Trump-esque, but can I interrupt for 1 second?
Yeah.
I would take issue with the word hammer because I think one of the things that works with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, too, is the tone, the persistence has to come with a certain low-key respect. It has to come in a controlled way. So it's not a hammering. It's a sweet hammering, a respectful hammering.
And this is why we have you here, because I have some questions about the journalistic convention of sweet hammering. You did say to Trump about Judge Curiel, but he's an American. He's from Indiana. You presented him with facts that undercut his entire argument such that it was. But elsewhere in this interview, and by the way, I'm talking about not just you, but all other TV interviewers, I found you tying yourself into knots by cleaving to these certain conventions that supposedly demonstrate objectivity with a capital O. For instance, and I'm going to play you some tape here, the reflex to put criticisms in other people's mouths.
Hillary Clinton said
that is a racist attack on a federal judge. Paul Ryan today said he didn't care for the way that you were attacking this judge. I guess the question from the Anti-Defamation League is, even if you don't know about their endorsement, there are these groups and individuals.
I saw Netanyahu put out a statement distancing himself from you.
Well, when David, you say, Cameron, no, not did. Distancing himself.
He condemned your remarks is all I'm saying.
He did. He modestly condemned them.
Jake, facts are facts. I mean, you did this fantastic takedown on your show on Trump's repulsive rumor-mongering about the Clintons and the Vince Foster suicide. You called it shameful.
To be clear, the notion that this was a murder is a fiction born of delusion and untethered to reality and contradicted by evidence reviewed in at least 6 investigations, one of them by Ken Starr.
But you sit across from him and you go into the sweet hammering mode. Why is that?
Well, there are different situations. Let me also say, as a general notion, my opinions about political events of the day are not as important as the opinions of some of the people you just played me referring to, Benjamin Netanyahu, Hillary Clinton. Those are world actors, and what they say is much more important than what I say. In an interview, one of the things that is important I have learned is to make the questions and the responses the stars of the interview. If I were to, you know, be like Joseph Welch taking on Senator Joseph McCarthy, at long last, sir, then I'm making myself the center of attention, and that undercuts the journalism. What's important in the exchange is a reporter sitting in front of him, and so as not to distract from what we're talking about, which is much more important than the personal interdynamics between me and Donald Trump, respectfully saying, but is this not the definition of racism?
Now, I understand you don't want to be caught grandstanding, although I would argue that at this moment in history, a little Joseph Welch grandstanding is just what the doctor ordered. But hyper-respect allows Trump and other political interviewees to be non-responsive, to go off on tangents. When you were asking about the very constitutionality of a wholesale ban on Muslims coming to the United States, he launches into a Second Amendment rant.
In California, if a couple of people like me had guns taped to their ankle or their waist, and these two horrible people came in, you wouldn't have all the death. You wouldn't have it. So look, I'm a big believer in the Constitution, okay?
And I'm sitting there going, no, Jake, that's not what you ask them. Interrupt them and say, Mr. Trump, I'm not asking you about political correctness or the Second Amendment. I'm asking you about legal discrimination, about racial profiling, about freedom of religion, the very thing that our country was founded on, and not because Benjamin Netanyahu asked it first. Is this not the moment to let yourself be the star?
You're talking about an interview that I did back in December. It was about a 20-minute interview, and I think I did about 15 minutes just on the Muslim ban. And I'm proud of those 15 minutes. And I would point to the impact that the most recent interview had. I would point to the Speaker of the House saying that's the definition of racism 5 days later, the same exact construct that I used during the interview, and say, I think the way that I brought it and the way that I was respectful to him while also making my points and trying to interject when he tried to change the subject, yeah, I think that worked. Also, I don't want this to be the last opportunity I have to interview them because I did not grandstand.
Well, that's a key point. How much is that in the calculus of your interviewing approach is that not only do I have to do this interview, but we have to maintain access so that...
But it's not about that. The fallacy is that it's about access for access's sake. It's not. It's about access so I can continue to do the journalism I'm doing. I don't want to cut myself out of this process. I think what I'm doing has value.
Is there not an argument, I'm certainly making it, for a change in the rules of engagement? I feel, and I've said this before, like watching the UN peacekeepers try to deal with the Bosnian Serbs. All they can do is watch as bad things happen. And when you're facing a demagogue, shouldn't you be able to fire back?
I don't know what alternative you're proposing. It sounds to me like you're asking for somebody to interview Hillary Clinton or interview Donald Trump and berate them. have some moment where it's about the interviewer.
How about you're running to be president of the United States, you've said outrageous things, and you're going to be held accountable for them. You mentioned the David Duke moment when you asked him if he would disavow the support of various white supremacists.
Well, just so you understand, I don't know anything about David Duke, okay? I don't know anything about what you're even talking about with white supremacy or white supremacists. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Did he endorse me or what's going on?
You said, well, it's the Ku Klux Klan, which I think was the right thing to say. And again, me, armchair quarterback interviewer, going, Trump, you just told me that you've never heard of former presidential candidate David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan. I don't believe that.
If you think that that was an ineffective interview, then all I can tell you is I disagree with you. I think it had an impact on the political dialogue because people at home filled in that sentence that you wish I had said. People at home did that for themselves. People at home figured out what they thought about the interview.
Fair enough, and I certainly understand that concept of the viewer filling in the blanks. The fundamental question, it's the one I began with, really, is that is this a moment in history where you sort of let a politician hang himself or not, with his own words, is simply not enough?
I think there are a lot of tough questions that need to be asked of Clinton and Trump. And I think the question for this media cycle is not whether or not people are being too respectful in asking them. I think they're not asking them. That, to me, is more troubling. Look, Donald Trump went on Fox and Friends and said Rafael Cruz, Ted Cruz's father, according to what he read in the National Enquirer, may have been involved with Lee Harvey Oswald in the Kennedy assassination. Now, the response on Fox and Friends was, oh, yeah, wow, what an outrage, or something like that. And the way it was covered over the next few hours was, you know, Trump levels charge, Cruz denies charge. That, to me, was outrageous. Because that's not journalism, that's stenography. And what I thought was important was that night to go on TV and say, this is false, and it's shameful, and it's wrong. That, to me, is important, too.
This guy, by every definition, is a demagogue. He has been caught in 1,000 lies. He has said all sorts of things that are fundamentally un-American. And is this a moment when it's proper to put the sweet hammer back in the toolbox and say, Mr. Trump, what is the matter with you?
You know, Bob, you can do that, and you can say all the things you just said about Mr. Trump, things that I have not said on my show. And at the end of the election cycle, we can decide which one of us has had more of an impact on the election.
Yeah, and what if he wins?
Then the majority of the American people have voted for him. My job is not to defeat a candidate. My job is to make sure voters have facts and have as much information as I can give them. At the end of the day, if the voters of this country pick Donald Trump to be their president, that's their decision. I'm not rooting for him or against him.
I'm rooting against him in a very big way. And I said that to my audience a few weeks ago, the voters will do what the voters will do, but it can't be because we in the press didn't do enough. Do you think that's just histrionics?
I think that the press could be doing more to challenge Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, to fact check, to make it clear when outrageous things are said or lies are told, and to ask follow-up questions. I could be doing a better job, and the media could be doing a better job, but I don't think I'm not doing my job. I think I've done a pretty good work of it already.
Jake, thank you very, very much.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Jake Tapper is host of CNN's The Lead with Jake Tapper and State of the Union. Coming up, the literati write an open letter condemning a demagogue. Is that too little, too late? This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we've heard, there are any number of ways for the nation's foremost name caller to be characterized himself, from liar to carnival barker to the ever-reliable short-fingered vulgarian. Back in December, we asked author and political theorist Michael Signer if Trump also deserved the epithet demagogue. He said, yep, what with his populism, scapegoating, his anti-democratic leanings, Trump is a textbook case. And yet, when we spoke to him back in January, Signer was optimistic because the founding fathers knew about the threat of demagogues, and they designed a system that was equipped to deal with them.
Demagogues thrive when we are cynical about truth. They start to deflate when we put faith back again in public reason. The American people, in the end, always choose that demagogues are beneath them.
6 months later, though, he's having second thoughts. Michael, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Your second thoughts aren't about whether Trump's a demagogue.
No, not at all. I think that's become even clearer.
The question is whether the democracy has the wherewithal to deal healthily with him. Why are you beginning to have nagging doubts?
Alexis de Tocqueville, who was the Frenchman who visited the United States in the 1830s and wrote the great book Democracy in America, which we still read, his thesis in that book was that regular everyday Americans were so committed to the health of the constitutional democracy that people were very wary about the concentration of power and corruption and tyranny. And that has given people over the beginning of our country a lot of grounds for optimism, saying that the people will always rescue the system from anybody who might prey on it, who might play to our prejudices or passions. The fact that Trump has gotten this close to the presidency gives me pause.
So Tocqueville observed that we understood the system and were all in with it. In the ensuing 185 years, do you believe the basic understanding of and appreciation for separations of power and rule of law and civil liberties have somehow dissipated?
That's what I'm worried about. You have a cultural cynicism about leadership that creates a boulevard that somebody like Trump can just drive right through by attacking any and all institutions as harmful to American greatness. You have a corrosion of civic knowledge among your kind of rank and file folks. I think that the media really has shelved its responsibility that it traditionally had for being a kind of conservator and influence over the values of freedom of speech and separation of powers. And then you have widespread economic anxiety and you have widespread national security fear that were pre-existing. And somebody like Trump comes along and he says, I'm not just going to play to those, I'm going to amplify them and sort of wrap them up into this message of I'm the one to solve all your problems. And all that together has created this perfect storm.
Are the circumstances such that the press should be getting out of its comfort zone of assiduous objectivity and become more confrontational?
Yes.
Because the
Yes.
threat is so large?
Yes. With a demagogue, the medium really is the message. When you give him the space to be an emotional entertainer, then he is winning that day by definition. So I think that people need to shake him out of that mode with tough, demanding questions and by confronting vacuums of fact or policy where they are and highlighting threats to our constitutional principles. The media, when they say, well, I'm just being objective and I'm going to just let him bluster on in my interview with him and not truly confront him because I'm being objective, it's not being objective. It's being a conspirator.
Paul Waldman, elsewhere on this program, says he believes we've turned a corner, that a couple of recent Trump ruptions, including Judge Curiel and his funding of veterans groups, have finally gotten a somnolent press awakened to its function to preserve an orderly democracy. Are you maybe a victim of premature consternation?
No. The lesson of history with demagogues is they're slippery as eels and they're quicksilver and they're chameleons. I think that Trump has the ability to change entire, not just narratives, but to change his entire appeal, you know, within another news cycle. It's about the passions and it's about the gut and it's about them. It's about their authoritarianism. Different rules apply. So I think that anybody who congratulates themselves or us for turning a corner without understanding that that corner has to be turned in the right way every single minute of every single day between now and election day is fooling themselves and is laying the groundwork toward doom. So I think that this calls for vigilance and constant action.
Notwithstanding the suspicion of the elites and the resentment about being the losers in globalism and feeling that you've lost your essential Americanness and all of those things he preys on, I just don't understand how he appeals to any single human being.
I know. The thing that people who just inherently hate him don't see is that there is an appeal. I think that his type is the rogue. That's really dangerous because the people who hate the rogue are not getting what's happening.
You know, I feel like I'm with my girlfriends in the bar and some guy with like his shirt open to his belly button and a lot of gold jewelry comes up and makes some sort of really obnoxious line. And my girlfriend's like going for it and walking away with him. And I'm thinking, wait, what, him? Ew.
That is the story of demagogues. The original demagogue in Athens was named Cleon. Everybody thought he smelled bad. He was the son of a tanner, I think, and he was a general, and he was sort of bombastic and vulgar. Vulgarity comes up a lot with demagogues. Their critics who miss them always think that they're just beneath, but they win by being beneath because there is a level that they're operating at that those critics not only they don't like, they just don't understand, and that's their glide path. It's exactly what happened with Hitler. I mean, remember people thought that it was just he was surrounded by thugs. It was unthinkable that you could have somebody like that move into actual power. But he did because people didn't take it seriously enough.
Well, I really appreciate you spending the time.
Thank you so much.
Michael Signer is author, lecturer at University of Virginia, and recently elected mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia. In a piece titled An Open Letter to the American People, Stephen King, Amy Tan, Juno Diaz, Dave Eggers, and scores of other American authors count the ways in which Trump is unfit for the presidency. To wit, the rise of a political candidate who deliberately appeals to the basest and most violent elements in society, who encourages aggression among his followers, shouts down opponents, intimidates dissenters, and denigrates women and minorities, demands from each of us an immediate and forceful response. Circulated on social media, the open letter has garnered more than 23,000 signatures. But Alexander Heman, Bosnian-American author and MacArthur genius, did not sign it. And not because he's a Trump supporter, it's because, Heman says, the letter implies Trump is an aberration, whereas he believes Trump is just the manifestation of something that's been brewing for a long time, during which time his author colleagues kept silent.
With all his rhetoric, he hasn't really done anything. The objection is to some extent rhetorical, whereas, well, I don't know, the 8 years of the Bush regime and then many things that followed were filled with things that were done, things that were abominable and criminal and violated any number of moral and legal tenets. And I do not remember, with all due respect, a letter signed by 500 or so writers opposing that.
So in essence, you're saying, oh, now you're complaining. The Iraq War and various other aspects of American adventurism have created untold damage, all under false pretenses. But now a reality show star is making a buffoon of himself and you've decided to band together?
There's a clear continuity. The traditional opposition to immigration and casual racism that was coded in various ways by the Republican Party is very much connected to Trump's rhetoric now. He just took off the coat. And that Republican Party was born and raised, as it were, during the Bush years. I do not oppose the letter. Far be it from me to suggest that this should not have been done. But once it's done, a can of worms is open. Now I'm picking through the worms.
You did get a little bit petulant with your colleagues when you said, you know, petitions are all well and good, but where is your political righteousness in your own writing? Where are the novels? Where are the stories that get to the heart of what is wrong in the society and with the political culture as it stands in 2016?
There is a lack of presence of the iniquities of the Bush years in American literature. Now, American literature is a vast project. 10,000 books a year are published that could be called literary fiction. So there are books like that somewhere. But if we take the pulse of American literature based on the awards and the reactions and reviews and the best-selling lists, you would be hard-pressed to find a talked-about book that was dealing with what happened during the Bush years, the undoing of the body politic, the diminishment of public space, the lies, the propaganda, the illegal actions, the mainstreaming of torture and eavesdropping and so on. If you look at the list of the Pulitzer Prize winners in the past 15 years, you would not be able to see what happened in this country in the past 15 years.
Point taken, and no literary critic am I, but one could make the argument that if you want a formula for writing a crappy novel, make it explicitly political. Society may be served by political fiction, but I'm not sure fiction is served by it.
I agree. I grew up in socialism. I was exposed in my education up to a time when I came to the United States to propaganda of various kinds. This is not what I'm proposing. There are other models. The French, after not dealing with what happened in World War II and in colonial times, started dealing with that in movies and in books. The history of British colonialism was brought back to the island, as it were, by the descendants of the colonized people. Describing the situation, Salman Rushdie said, "Empire writes back." So we can write back not to correct or to pontificate, but rather to create a space to understand what happened to us, not what happened in the elections in 2016, but what happened to us as a communion of equal citizens.
Can you give me an example or a literary model for taking on the question of what has happened in the American psyche to lead us to this place?
Well, one of the books I've really liked is Ben Fountain's Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk. It addressed the spectacle of war and the fallacy of worshiping the images of heroes without addressing the calamity that war is. And it's funny and thoughtful. But it's not one or two books. It has to be a collective effort. The problem with propaganda is that it always speaks with one voice. Fiction allows for conversations that cannot quite be had in public space defined by media or social media. I grew up reading the great German writers of the 70s, Günter Grass, Heinrich Böll, and Siegfried Lenz. After the 60s and terrorism in Germany and the fact that children asked their parents, "What did you do in World War II?" many writers came out with these books and they were translated because they were a big deal all over Europe. What a novel can do, what literature can do, is create a world to understand the issues that the public is deliberately ignoring.
You came here in 92 from Sarajevo, which was under siege by Bosnian Serbs, egged on by Slobodan Milosevic, whose playbook sounded exactly like what Trump has embraced now. The same kinds of calls to national character, the same kind of calls to a dangerous other.
In fact, I've written a piece for Rolling Stone Online comparing Trump and a Serbian fascist called Vojislav Šešelj, who used to say outrageous things before the war started, and many of us laughed it up, thinking just, you know, how bizarre it all is. And then it turned out that this was an introduction to his military methodology. So I take Trump very seriously, and I do commend the writer's desire to oppose Trump, but the stakes are so high that we ought to think very carefully how we oppose something like that and what it is that we oppose, because Milosevic would have been nothing without taking over a military and political structure that allowed him to perform all those operations. In other words, Milosevic had more than rhetoric. Rhetoric was a necessary but not a sufficient condition. Some other conditions had to be met, and those conditions are in place in this country, and those state and military and political mechanisms could be taken over by someone else. So to eliminate Trump would not settle things. I would not want to think that somehow if Trump vanishes or if he loses the elections, that we will be back to normal. The normal is no longer available.
Sasha, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Alexander Hemen is a Bosnian-American author of several books, including The Making of Zombie Wars and The Lazarus Project. It is possible, of course, that these times are not so extraordinary, that Trump's ravings are not all that different in substance from that which has been dog-whistled for decades. Maybe all the public needs is a genuinely tough and responsible media, not a truculent one. The media can just wield their sweet hammers and methodically tap, tap away. But what if something different is going on? Something scary that puts our freedom of religion and of the press at risk? Something fundamentally unconstitutional and un-American? How then would you have our media watchdogs conduct themselves? Politely? Neutrally? I only ask because watchdogs are supposed to be scary, not just because they bark, but because they bite. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. We had more help from Jack D'Isidoro, Emma Stelter, and Isabel Christo. And our show was edited by executive producer Katya Rogers and Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.